You're listening to Catch the Current, the coolest seafood podcast out there from the team at Undercurrent News, your trusted source for seafood prices, news, and data. I'm Amanda Buckle.
And I'm Lauren Castiglione. Amanda and I had the ultimate FOMO this week as Undercurrent's very own Dan Gibson reported live from the 2025 Shrimp Summit held at the Grand Hyatt Bali Hotel in Indonesia. The summit, which took place June 23rd through the 25th, is an annual event hosted by nonprofit the Center for Responsible Seafood, led by former Global Seafood Alliance president and founder George Chamberlain.
We've got the worst FOMO, but we're getting Dan back by forcing him to record this podcast with us past 10 o'clock at night. So welcome, Dan. Tell us everything about the Shrimp Summit. I need to know all about the welcome reception in the Coconut Garden and the gala banquet cocktail hour on the beach.
Well, I mean, the thing is, when you mention the Coconut Garden, that's actually, that was one of the lesser events of this this summit, to be
honest. Stop it.
I will say the Shrimp Summit is probably my favorite event of the year to cover. When you get to come out to places like this, it's a huge part of it, of course. And also just the time gap of when you're reporting in the UK, I'm coming online as all my contacts in Asia are going off home for the day. So to come here and meet people in person, it's once a year. It's always a dream show to cover.
Is it always in Bali?
No, it rotates. That's the beauty of it. So this is my first time in Indonesia ever.
Okay.
And before last year, it was in India. The year before was Vietnam. I don't know yet where it's going to be next year. Normally they announce it. This time it was George Chamberlain, the event organizer. He was keeping tight lips on where it's going to be next year. So
much uncertainty and so much chaos right now that nobody wants.
That's quite
to
possible.
That
I don't think it'll be a question of no one wants to take it on as much as they don't know exactly where would make the most sense, because you know, they always bring in a US panel every year to discuss the US market and basically just inform all of these Asian farmers and producers, you know, what's the current market trends. And what's fascinating in this year's panel is they ended it with a poll, an audience poll, and they said, what's the main threats facing the shrimp sector right now? And I kid you not, 100% of the replies were the threat of US tariffs.
100%.
Like, there wasn't even
a,
yes, they gave it a multiple choice thing of five options. Everybody in the room, and there were about 200 of us in the room, everybody picked the threat of US tariffs because it just loomed large over the entire event. It was the elephant, literally, in the room.
Yeah, you covered a lot of this. I don't even know where to begin. NFI was there.
So it started with Robert DeHaan. He was the general counsel of NFI and the executive vice president. And he was there to give, it has to be said, a very sobering rundown to a room full of Asian producers from countries who thought they were America's friends and allies and don't fully understand why they're being slapped with heavy tariffs. And I think many of them are still under the assumption that this is all this negotiating ploy, it will go away, there will be, you know, countries will make a deal, maybe it will give US better market access, but in the end it will go back to how it was. But he poured cold water on that and he said, look, I've been through the documents, this is a concerted effort by the US to adjust what it sees as an unfair trade imbalance in order to help US producers, but this will come at the expense of, you know, countries in Asia. And he says this is like almost certainly going to happen. And he said, if you think it's just going to be restricted to China, we are past that, with his exact words. Like, it's going to be much more than that. And he said as well, like, talking about the legal aspects of it, so I understand that there's been an appeal and it's going to the courts. And he said, you know, don't expect Congress to do anything, so it's going to be ultimately decided between the president and the courts in the US. And he said, if the appeal wins and the tariffs get revoked, then you'll guess all of the money that's already been paid in tariffs is going to have to be paid back again, which is just going to be extraordinary levels of disruption.
So I don't know if you've read Jason's latest article, but he said U.S. seafood importers, he calculated, paid nearly $85.4 million in tariffs in April. That's nearly four times the $23.5 million paid in April 2024. So, yeah, imagine them having to pay back. That's wild.
Yeah, well, I can actually add to that, because Ragnar Neustil from Kontali had done some sort of very quick summary based on the value, the import value from each of these Asian countries. And he found that, first of all, 70% of imported shrimp to the US will be exposed from July 9th to a tariff rate over 25%. And the second thing, he'd done a calculation basically of, if these tariffs were in place last year, the cost to the importer would have been $1.5 billion across the whole year, the additional cost from these tariffs. And what's also interesting is, of course, Vietnam. I noticed it in our coverage. We said Vietnam is, they are facing the biggest one. on paper. I think it's 46%, is it? But because of the volumes that come from both India and Indonesia, that tariff is potentially more crippling to the shrimp industry and as a whole. Yeah, the cost, even though India is only 26%, counts for a sizable chunk. I don't know if it's quite the majority, but a sizable chunk of the US's imported shrimp supply. So the effective cost to the importer of that will be double the effective cost of the tariffs on Vietnam and the tariffs on Indonesia. Yeah, it's huge amounts. And what was interesting was they then had a panel with these producer nations asking, what are you going to do? Worst case scenario, the tariff stays in place, nothing happens. So where are you going to put it? And in India, they're looking into their domestic market. Of course, it's a nation with a long history of vegetarianism, but shrimp is a growing product there. And if even like 10% of the Indian consumer decided they wanted to try shrimp, that would, take huge volumes off their hands. Likewise, Vietnam is growing its own live shrimp consumption, and some of the figures show that the fastest growing markets for shrimp consumption globally are in Southeast Asia. So you could end up seeing this, mass redirection there. And then in Indonesia, we're talking about selling more to EU and Japan. So that's, yeah, again, just sort of a wild move away from the US, because I think the important context to be aware here is even though the US is the single biggest importer of shrimp globally, it only accounts for 20% of global shrimp consumption. So feasibly, if there are huge tariffs, it is possible for these countries to diversify away, but it will be very expensive. It will take a lot of time. And when you consider the relationships they have obviously built up in the US, it would seem like a tremendously crippling thing for very little purpose, as far as I can tell.
I think the Global Shrimp Council hopped on just in time. It seems like a lot of people could probably use their help right now.
Yeah. That's the thing. The only country, of course, that's not worried about this and which decidedly rosy the whole time was Ecuador. And what was interesting that came out of the show was that this year Ecuador's on track to have more value-added and headless shell-on products and cooked products than raw headless, was it, head-on shell-on products. Because that was always the staple of what they did, was just they would just farm it, ship it, and do very little processing themselves. But because of the opening that's turned up now in the US, where A, they're closer than Asian countries, B, they only have a 10% tariff. It doesn't look likely that there's going to be any change to that. So, they have that advantage over them. And C, they're now suddenly getting all of this interest from US importers who've realized that Ecuador seems to be just growing exponentially. I mean, they're up 10% this year, expected to. They're up higher than that right now. But yeah, that was the forecast for a 10% growth. And when they're already on 1.4 million metric tons, I mean, yeah, there's room there for them to double, apparently, as well, which, I mean, that would be obscene. They're already the biggest producer by far, but 3 million
Obscene.
metric tons in
That
one
is an
country?
obscene
I
amount
mean,
of shrimp.
yeah. So, I mean, they're doing very well there for themselves. And it was interesting going across the panel of producers asking, what's your biggest fear? And it was US tariffs and disease, US tariffs and disease, US tariffs and disease. Gisa Sandro Cogliatore of Amasa, and he says, it's going to be tricky how we're going to increase the density. We've got to really, pay attention so that we can just keep on upping these volumes. And it's, yeah, completely different page basically for the Ecuadorians right now. But I don't know. They weren't there in bulk. It was only him and Alan Cooper from Vitapro. The vast majority of the attendance was from Asia. So I
Okay.
dare say we'll see a lot more of the Ecuadorians at the Global Shrimp Forum in Utrecht in a few months' time.
So with all this tariff talk, talking about shifting demand hopefully to other areas, but what about, US retail?
As of yet, no. Right now, if anything, it is slightly up at the start of the year, and I think big chunk of that has been so much volume that they're getting in before the tariffs hit. They know there's this 90-day pause. Everybody is frantically shipping shrimp to the US right now. And as of yet, there has not been any decided impacts. Going to Eric Bloom from the Eastern Fish Company. And yeah, the problem he did say is that the next few months are going to be key, because already they are now starting to see product that's coming in under tariff conditions, under this 10% baseline, is now starting to hit the market. So the question they have is, will consumers downgrade to other products? Will they shift to domestic proteins? And will they buy less shrimp? And is there any way to mitigate that as well? I mean, can you sell, for instance, a lower count of shrimp, or a different product that comes in at the same price, but perhaps will be less volume? So yeah, that's a question of wait and see, I guess. But
This always now is reminding me of COVID, and I never wanted to talk about COVID again after COVID hit, because we talked about COVID
of
forever. Now
course.
I'm feeling the same way with the tariffs. But when COVID hit, I really was curious to see what consumption you know, figures would do. And now we're going to have to wait a couple of years, but NFI always compiles based on NOAA's data what U.S. consumption numbers are. And it's a couple of years behind, like I said, but it's going to be really interesting to see what 2025's numbers are and to see, because shrimp usually is the top item, usually by far.
Yeah, roughly 20-30% of the seafood sales value at retail in the U.S., they said, is shrimp. And it's always been the number one. I think last year, apparently, salmon overtook it, but that was a function of salmon being ludicrously expensive. This year, given the U.S. is so dependent on imported shrimp, and especially from these countries that are going to be seeing, as it stands, incredibly high tariff hikes, and you have to imagine that the consumer will be asked to pay that. It's not something that you can't just absorb like a 26% hike. They said that when they had tariffs on China, if it was just 10%, that was absorbed. Nobody complained. They are not expecting any sort of immediate response, but again, if the July 9th deadline passes, there are no new deals, and more to the point, there are no extensions, because if you're in negotiations, as Robert Dehaan said, was that they expect, if they're acting in good faith, then they may get extensions. That's not to be ruled out. But if there are no extensions, if it just, you know, goes ahead as is, then yeah, that would have, you would think, a pretty crippling impact on shrimp demand in the short term, at least.
Which brings me to my next question. I'm obsessed with Red Lobster, primarily the Cheddar Bay biscuits. I have such a weakness for them. Lauren and I once tried to toss them into each other's mouths. Didn't quite catch them. But anyway, I noticed that a representative from Red Lobster was in attendance in Bali.
Yes. So he was there giving the food service outlook on this panel. So you had Travis Larkin from Seafood Exchange, and you had, as mentioned, Eric Bloom. And then they turned to Matt asking, okay, how does food service respond to this? And Red Lobster is obviously a very unique space, given that they are far more seafood oriented than most food service chains in the US. They've had to make this very sharp adjustment from having endless shrimp, sort of relentless shrimp being promoted there, almost cutting the bottom out of the shrimp market. And now suddenly they realize, oh no, this is pretty much the last thing they wanted to happen was tariffs imposed on all of the shrimp that's going to be coming in. So suddenly they're having to dial back not just the volumes of shrimp and these offers that they were doing as promotional things, but they're even having to change the menu items, so it will be shrimp and beef or shrimp and chicken. And it will be sort of shrimp served alongside a domestic protein, just to try and keep the cost down. Because as he said, it's shrimp's role on their menu is as a low price item. So they can't pass on a price increase of that magnitude at all to their customers. It's not the role that shrimp has for them. So yeah, they said it's still going to play a role on their menu. It's always going to be there. They say it ranges between 50 to 75% of their seafood value. So it always plays a massive role for Red Lobster, and it's not going to leave. They're just going to have to find new ways to repackage it, in which perhaps it's no longer center of the plate, which coming from Red Lobster is like an earthquake.
No, I mean, the timing of that was interesting because they did just end their Shrimp Sensations deal, which was $19.99. It was a 3-course, you know, meal to entice, you know, customers to come into the restaurant. And they swapped it out for Crab Fest, which, you know, not another great promotion to run right now. I mean, they're basically just down to snow crab at this point, which is like a huge cry from like 10 years ago when they had Dungeness and King Crab. Like, you're right, you have to shift. They also just added a seafood boil. In there is sausage. You know, yeah, you got that shrimp in there. You have a couple of crab legs, but you're adding those other proteins in to add that value. So yeah, no, it's definitely interesting timing to see that.
Don't use us to refer to the entire food service space, because obviously Red Lobster is so famous for the shrimp offers and the shrimp promotion. He did briefly touch on the endless shrimp promotion that they had before, which of course was widely held as the reason why they were having so many financial struggles, because they felt it didn't pay itself. But no, that was quite funny, almost a tongue-in-cheek way at this point. Like, everyone knows about endless shrimp. It's word went around. Yeah, it's not an end to shrimp, to be clear, Red Lobster, just a dialing back. And they say it's gone from, as I say, 75% down to about 55% of their seafood value. So it's still the big one. It's just less of it.
Well, I want to let you get some sleep, but before you go, we talked about tariffs, but you said the other big topic of conversation at the event was disease.
Shrimp disease is always a talking point at this show. It is always a rampant problem in some of these Asian countries, because they have a very intensive farming model. Obviously, does increase the stress on the shrimp and makes them more susceptible to diseases there. And they, to be honest, it doesn't sound like it ever gets much better. There's EHP, which slows down the growth of the shrimp. There's EMS, early mortality syndrome, and white spot, the ever-present threat of white spot, which again, just they can lose whole crops to it. So I think what you've seen this year is there was again more talk on broodstock and on high quality genetic selection. It's always one of the more visited topics at the show. But there was also a couple of innovations which were particularly interesting in the Innovation Summit, in my opinion. There was one company from Boston, Massachusetts, a spin-off lab, manufacturing bacteriocins is the idea. So these effectively serve the same role as an antibiotic would, but without any of the residue, which is obviously fantastic, given that the EU has clamped down on antibiotic residue in shrimp ponds and in imported shrimp. And then there was also this company, Dalan, who's manufactured the first vaccine for insects in honeybees, which, they made a presentation because they're also doing one for shrimp and for white spot. And that, they said, is tentatively looking to come out in 2028. So, yeah, it's still a long way away, but if there was some kind of genuine vaccine for white spot, that would just save so many Asian farmers. You'd be talking millions of dollars here because it's such a bane. In India these days, the average survival rate is only 60% on a lot of these farms because disease is such a problem. And particularly during the summer months when it gets hot, when the pathogen load is high, many of them have just started switching from Vanname to Black Tiger, which grows slower, but it's endemic, it's native, and it doesn't suffer from these diseases. So yeah, they make less money, but they still actually produce a shrimp at the end of it. So you're seeing that switch happening as well in the meantime.
All right, Dan, you proved to us that you were actually at this conference and not actually out enjoying Bali.
I kid you, I was out in the jungle the whole time. I was just tuning in over the internet every now and then to think, how can I convince them I was really there?
Well, honestly, encourage everyone to look at the blog if you haven't done so already, because you had to have developed carpal tunnel while working on it. It is jam-packed with all this content. We only just like really, grazed over it. So seriously, go check it out.
Thanks, Amanda.
Well, there's no better person to follow up Dan Gibson's live reporting on all things shrimp from Bali than Matt Craes, the founder and lead researcher of Spheric Research. Matt is a longtime collaborator and partner of Undercurrent News and Spheric Research, the producer of the annual land-based aquaculture report, which we lovingly refer to as LBAR, will now maintain a live database of all its sector research with weekly updates and a monthly analytical report, all hosted by Undercurrent News. So, Matt, this is the fifth edition of the LBAR. So, hopefully, our listeners have been able to get their hands on a previous copy. But for those who haven't, what is the land-based aquaculture report and who is it a must-read for?
Thanks, Amanda. So when I started doing this report, it was 2018 and I was at Aquanaur and I walked into a room that was so full of people. It was like when the World Cup soccer is on and you see people appearing over people's shoulders to see the presentations. And it was the RAS seminar. And I thought, gosh, that looks interesting. And it was at the time, everybody was very excited about the ability to for the salmon farming companies to do bigger smolts and improve all types of productivity metrics. And also the fact that Atlantic Sapphire, a company that started in Scandinavia, had successfully farmed salmon on land and more than 1,000 tons from one site in Denmark. And I would say Danish Salmon as well achieved that same goal. And then Atlantic Sapphire was building the facility in Miami that a lot of people will know about as having had many setbacks and hundreds of millions of dollars invested. So that was our entry point. And we did the first report in 2020. It was actually just on the salmonids. The next year we added other species, which was like a massive effort because there are a lot of projects around the world that have tried to raise species that are almost, under threat of overfishing, like, for example, sturgeon to grow the most expensive caviar and all types of other stuff. And so we followed it through a roller coaster ride over five editions where we've gone through what looks like a hype cycle where you have everyone gets terribly excited and lots of investment. Then you have this sort of trough of people, getting totally spooked in terms of investment flow. Right now, we're in this super interesting phase where there are fewer projects, so there's fewer speculative type, earlier type projects around. But then there's a smaller group of projects that are really located in certain countries that are investing huge sums of money in the sector. And that's super exciting. And we also track the smolt investment as well, which is a big deal.
You're talking about all different species. Start off with salmon. That's mind-blowing to me because I'm looking at there's a digital version, which we'll get into in a little bit. But the species that you're covering now is so far beyond Atlantic salmon. I mean, yellowtail, eel, vaname shrimp, steelhead trout. I could go on and on. I mean, it's really amazing. And then from the list of countries too as well. So actually, let's just dive into it. What can you tell us about the digital aspect of this report?
Yeah, the digital aspect was the fact that we were tracking so many projects over time. And we were really struggling to produce, you know, on a very practical level, the report, because the reports that became like a 250-page monstrosity.
But it's filled with so much. I mean, it's not just all text, though. Mm. It's graphs, it's charts, it's beautiful. So the 250 pages, yeah, I mean, a lot of work went into that.
Yes. Yeah, you'll know from covering seafood industry news that there's an awful lot that goes on every single month in the sector. There's no end of investment and things going on. And so we decided that what we would start to do is to actually come up with a monthly sort of insights, what we call a monitor, where we're tracking everything that's going on each month. What we found is that a lot of companies have come to rely on this information. There's a lot of the companies that are in the sector that use the information for investor presentation material, for financing rounds, which is pretty key. And we also have clients, the financial sector, so the lenders to this industry, and then industry suppliers. Okay. And so the fact that we were just a once a year publication and there was so much going on led us to think that we need to do this in a better way. And so we came up with the idea of, one, updating the projects as there were updates, and secondly, having the monitor, which provides some kind of analysis 12 months a year and also just brings together everything that's going on.
Yeah, I'm looking at the May report right now. That's the latest one that's been released. And it's 5 pages. It's really concise, and which is really nice for somebody just within all aspects of the industry, like you said. It's these bullet points of what you need to know from what happened throughout the month, broken down by companies. It's really fantastic. So I'm going to include a link to that in our show notes.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. You know, Amanda, what we also do as well is that, like, between myself and the team, we travel to a lot of conferences in a year. And so we're at the North Atlantic Seafood Forum. We invest very heavily in the report. We visit sites as well. Now there are more dedicated conferences in Norway. So we've been to events actually just in Norway that are all in Norwegian language. I'll go to Equinor this year. So really, the monitor also gave us this window of opportunity to give year-round analysis on topics that we might not cover in the report, which has perhaps become more of a state of the industry type document each year.
You want to have that report just because all that information is there. This monthly report, it's a little less intimidating. And as I said, it's really like user friendly, which is, you know, I love it. So the actual annual report for the fifth edition, the 2025, isn't out yet. Now it's coming out soon, correct?
Yes, imminently. Yeah. It's coming out very, very soon. The annual report has really evolved as well. I'm quite proud of what we're about to put out. We've done one or two social media posts on LinkedIn where we've talked about, for example, the estimated deal flow. So we're doing a lot more in this report. And it has evolved each year. But this one is going to be quite special because the way that we, for example, look at things like deal flow, we now have very consolidated CapEx averages that we use to calculate deal flow that we can't see. So, you know, you have these publicly traded companies in Norway, you kind of know how much those companies are raising over time. And we also look at the composition of the deal flow. So we're talking equity and debt. So what we're seeing is there's more debt deals. So that basically means that there are some of these companies are able now to tap into the Nordic bond market like Anfield Salmon did the other day. So that tells a story of a growing sophistication of the sector. And what you're also seeing, the big thing is you're seeing in certain countries, and I've mentioned Iceland and Japan, you're seeing banks getting involved and really backing the sector. So the amount of information that we now have, for example, on deal flow is way more sophisticated. Like, we're now able to actually calculate the estimated industry size and truly based, you know, using these averages and formulas and a model. And we're able to kind of estimate what is going to happen. We predict that there's going to be potentially close to $2 billion in deal flow this year going into salmon on growing, which is remarkable, and other species, but it's pretty much all salmon. And then you have in the 2022 to 2026 period, we calculate to be $500 million a year being invested in post-smolt systems, pretty much between Faroe Islands and Norway. So the industry's probably much bigger than everybody thinks. If you just think about the actual mechanics of fish tanks and all of the companies that provide the stuff to it, you know.
Now, as someone being in the industry as long as you have and working on this report for a couple of years now, it's got to be really interesting, exactly what you said, to watch this evolution and seeing what's shifting and what the trends are going. So that's amazing. Be the first one to access this report. We'll have the link there. Matt, any final words?
I just think that if you're following this sector and you're interested, there's lots of governments that are interested in this technology. Today, that I would mention that there was a report that came out of British Columbia, or maybe in the last couple of days, that actually cites our data, but it rubbishes the theory that you could replace all of British Columbia's salmon farms with RAS farms. And, you know, we're not mouthpieces for the industry, right? I mean, the data shows that full RAS with a biofilter is still a tricky technology, and it's higher cost in terms of capex. You can see that even this latest generation of companies like Proximar of Japan and Nordic Aqua Partners have had early setbacks. In contrast, you've had a very good early run from Salmon Evolution, suggesting that the hybrid flow through model is doing really well. I'd say that it's a very interesting time in the industry. The success of the hybrid technology has really given a lot of hope to investment, and clearly, you know, salmon is a business that you can make a lot of money out of. I would also say, as we track the post-smolt investments, the biggest opportunity to increase salmon supply in the world is if you had different policies from countries like Canada and Chile to encourage post-smolt investment. If you were able to get that same level of investment that you've had from Faroe Islands and Norway, you're actually improving the industry because you're improving mortality. You know, anecdotally, we know that all of these big salmon companies like Mowi are telling us that mortality is cut quite dramatically when you invest in post-smolt systems. Now, I'm quite excited about the information that we've managed to get there as well. I think it's a really fascinating topic. And we're able to correlate how salmon production is evolving with these investments. And I've been spending a lot more time on that data this year. I'd say that's the stuff that I'm quite interested in.
I'd
love to see more investment in the other species. That would be the one as well. That would be very cool. But there's some, but there could be more.
Something to watch in the future. Again, access to the LBAR report. Be the first one to get it. Links in the show notes. Thanks, Matt.
Well, that does it for us this week. Tune in next week as we dissect Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez's wedding menu.
I heard they were serving octopus for breakfast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back here next week.
Bye-bye.